Before we begin, a couple of housekeeping announcements. First of all, if all of you could please check your mobiles, make sure they're off or at least muted. If we all look at them at the same time, nobody should be embarrassed to do so. And I'd like to ask everybody, including the back, to do so now. Second of all, I'd like to mention our next event coming up on Wednesday. We have somebody who many of you may know, former editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review, Nayan Chanda, now at the Yale Center for the Study of Globalization. And he'll be talking about traders, preachers, adventurers, and warriors, their role in shaping globalization based on his new book coming out. That's, again, Wednesday evening. More immediately, however, we have somebody who has also looked at different forces in globalization, particularly those between the Mideast and China, one of the fastest growing and most interesting international commercial connections. Our speaker today is Ben Simpfendorfer. He is the chief China economist for the Royal Bank of Scotland. However, the subject of the Mideast, of course, is far afield from his responsibilities there, so the opinions he's expressing today are his own and not those of the Royal Bank of Scotland, and they arise from his book, which is just out, which I recommend to all of you. It's How a Rising Arab World is Turning Away from the West and Rediscovering China, and you can pick it up at the front table here. Ben is uniquely qualified to write on this subject as one of the few people I know who speaks Arabic and Chinese. He has worked in Beirut, Damascus, Beijing, and Hong Kong, and has a broad experience in both regions, and he'll tell us a little bit today about how those two regions are coming together. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. It's a real pleasure to be here today. We are a witness to what is a historic rebalancing in the global economy. I spoke about this subject last week in Abu Dhabi at a private equity conference, and I started with a series of charts and tables. You have to as an economist, otherwise people don't take you seriously. But I continued to tell a number of stories that I've witnessed over the last 3 years as I've researched the book in cities like Cairo, Dubai, Damascus, Riyadh, and Beijing. It was only when I started to tell the stories that people start to really pay attention, and I sympathize with them because I think charts and tables or acronyms like BRICS and CHIMES just don't do this story justice. More importantly, they can often be misleading. And I guess that's the message I really want to leave you with today, is that it's individuals who are at the heart of this story, not companies and not governments. And that's why I want to tell you three stories in particular that I think do a great job of underscoring the changes at work. Those first of those stories starts with Abdul Madani. Today I won't be using charts and tables. Just these three stories. No worries. I begin with the story of Abdul Madani. He is a Syrian textiles trader. He has an office in the old city of Damascus. It's 3 centuries old. It's made of wood and plaster, and it leans out crookedly into the street. Now, Abdul Madani isn't alone. There are a lot of Syrian traders who have offices like him in the old city of Damascus. It disguises their wealth from the government. He was a trader in American-made textiles, but not anymore, not since September 2001. He now finds it very difficult to visit the United States, and he's not unusual. The number of Arab visitors to the United States has fallen from 250,000 to 180,000 in less than a decade. Fortunately, Abdul Madani has a choice. China finished its negotiations to enter the World Trade Organization in, ironically, September 2001. It entered the following year. Its exports, in particular its textile exports, surged as a result. More importantly, the Chinese government unofficially relaxed its visa policy at around the same time. So just a few years ago, it took the average Egyptian trader 18 days to receive a visa to the United States, if he received a visa at all. It took the same trader just 1 day to receive a visa to China. So the number of Arab visitors to China has surged as a result. There's a small city called Yiwu. It's a four-hour drive south of Shanghai. It receives, or it is arguably the world's largest wholesale consumer goods market. It receives 200,000 Arab visitors every year. There are over a dozen Arabic restaurants in its main street. You can eat Egyptian, Syrian, Yemeni, whatever you like. And in part, that reflects China's entry into the World Trade Organization and its relaxation of its visa policy, and clearly September 2001. Now, Abdul Madani doesn't have, or he isn't a regular visitor to Yiwu, but what he does have is an office in Shanghai. He now employs four Chinese staff. He communicates with them by email and phone. And perhaps most ironically, he now exports Chinese-made textiles to the United States using his old contacts from the United States. I like this story because I think it underscores two important points. The first is, again, it is individuals, not companies and governments, who are central to the changes at work. That's important because companies can change their strategy, governments can change their policy, but what we are witnessing is tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of individuals in this region are changing the way they interact with the global economy. And that's a very powerful change indeed that won't be reversed in a hurry. The second point is that there is a tendency, or the events over the last decade have been nothing short of historic, but there is a tendency to view them as isolated, whether it is September 2001, the World Trade Center attacks, China's entry to the World Trade Organization, the rise in oil prices, the rise of Dubai. They are, in fact, all interrelated in some way. I think a nice way to underscore that point is to tell the story of the Hadhramutis. The Hadhramutis are a tribe based in the Gulf Peninsula, in the Gulf Peninsula. They have easy access to trade winds, and historically they have always been big traders. You can find Hadhramutis across the region, in particular in Singapore and Indonesia. The Hadhramutis were the first to arrive in China after 2001, in particular in 2004 as oil prices started to rise. They were mainly arriving to try or to provide consumer goods to the Saudi Arabian market, which is the biggest consumer market in China. Ironically, Osama bin Laden is also a Hadhramuti, or his father was. And he's used those same trade, his organization in some way reflects those same trade networks that spread across this region, and in particular into Afghanistan. So again, I just think that underscores the point that some of the events we've seen over the past decades have very strong interlinkages, even though that may not seem immediately apparent. The second story is that of a Chinese Muslim called Ma Guoming. I met Ma in Yiwu. Ma is an Arabic speaker. He works as an Arabic translator. His Arabic is good. He speaks standard Arabic, Fusha, and he also speaks, or understands at least, a number of dialects. Ma isn't unusual. There are over 1,000 Arabic translators in Yiwu. There are even more across the rest of the country. Not all of them speak good Arabic, but most of them do. Most of them have learned their Arabic in religious schools, or what the Chinese government would like to call Arabic Chinese schools, education schools. They were mainly brought up in the western provinces, in fairly poor provinces, and so when Arab visitors to cities such as Yiwu, but also Guangzhou and Chuanzhou and Beijing, Shanghai, started to surge, they responded or realized there was an opportunity to lift themselves out of that grinding poverty and to work as Arabic translators in these coastal provinces. I like this story because it underscores, again, two important points. The first is that Islam is central to the rise of the East, the rise of the new Silk Road economies. The Chinese Muslims, in particular those from the Huizhou minority, play a very important role in strengthening trade relations between China and the Mideast. You can find them all across the Mideast. Not just working as traders, but even studying Islam, in particular in the Abu Nur Institute in Damascus. There are large numbers of Chinese Muslims, or Huizhou. The second is the Chinese government's response to Islam is it has, if not encouraged, it's certainly permitted Chinese Muslims to study Arabic in these religious schools. And it now recognizes that Arabic is a way to lift, again, these Chinese Muslims out of, again, grinding poverty in these Western provinces. So it encourages that that flow to the coastal provinces. Yiwu Municipal Council is another good example of the government's stance or policy towards Islam. It's actually built a mosque. It's also built an Islamic kindergarten with the sole intention of trying to attract more Muslim traders to Yiwu. I would be hard-pressed today to find a Western government that is behaving in the same way. The third story is of a Chinese author you may know, Song Hongbing. He's written a book called Currency Wars, in which he describes how the West has used its currency policy to prevent the rise of the East. The book has chapters titled, for instance, Financial Nuclear Weapons Target Tokyo, in which he describes how the 1985 Plaza Accord signed between Japan and four Western countries was intended to produce rapid appreciation of the yen and the collapse of the Japanese economy. Critics will argue this is nothing more than conspiracy theory. That may be true, but the book is a bestseller, and reportedly it's read by a large number of senior officials, so it may even have an influence on the country's currency policy. Most importantly, though, the book is not just popular in China, it's also popular in the Middle East. I was watching Al Jazeera 2 weeks ago, a program called Bila Hadood, or No Limits. It's hosted by Ahmed Mansour. It's very popular in the Middle East. Who was he interviewing? Song Hongbing, in Arabic via a translator. So we have, on the one hand, a Chinese language book. On the other, we have an Arabic interview of that Chinese language book. And both have a significant influence, or at least an influence, on popular opinion in this region. And yet you're unlikely to read about either in the English language media. I like this story in particular because I think it helps to underscore that the flow of ideas is increasingly between, not just between East and West, but also within the East itself. And that's what the old Silk Road was all about, was that flow of ideas within the East, whether it was Buddhism or Islam. There's another story or anecdote I saw or read just a week ago that helps, again, to underscore this point. There was a Syrian governor, or he was, in fact, is a central party committee member of the Ba'ath Party, Syrian Ba'ath Party, but he's also a provincial governor of a northeastern province called Al-Hakasa. It neighbors Iraq to the west and to the east, and Turkey to the north. He was in Hunan province with 15 other officials. You might ask why Hunan province. If you're on a junket, surely Beijing and Shanghai would be more appropriate. But the point was, he wasn't on a junket. He was on a study trip. And Hunan province is a poor province, an agricultural province, and exports a lot of labor to the coastal provinces. Well, the provincial governor is governor of a province that is poor province, agricultural province, that exports a lot of labor to urban cities. So the economic reform experience of Hunan province is directly relevant to Al-Hakasa province, and certainly more directly relevant than the economic reform experience of either Europe or the United States. So again, I think this story just helps to illustrate how the flow of ideas increasingly is within the East itself rather than between the East and the West. So the book itself deals mainly with sort of Arab and China-Mid East relations. But for those who don't know, I also have a blog in which I write a weekly commentary on the broader region, the Silk Road economies. And I wanted to leave you with, I think, what are four points that certainly helped me to understand what the rise of the Silk Road economies is about. The first of those points is that high oil prices are bad, not good for the Silk Road. This might appear counterintuitive, but if you look at the Silk Road countries, and I estimate there are about 40 of those, so I include everything between Korea and Morocco, The majority of those countries are net oil importers, so they consume more oil than they produce. They account, or these net oil importers account for 80% of the region's output. So, Saudi Arabia might be the world's largest oil producer, but its economy is smaller than Taiwan. So oil prices at $100 a barrel will kill off Chinese manufacturers and ultimately kill off the Middle East growth story. So oil prices, in my view, at around about $70 a barrel are at a level that's appropriate enough to allow Chinese manufacturers to still make a profit while at the same time be able to fund, for instance, Saudi Arabia's aggressive CapEx expansion projects. The second point is that the economic crisis is not the end of the Silk Road story. I have to admit I was worried about that about a year ago. I just was near to finishing the book and the world turned upside down. And I thought, wow, this could be a real waste of effort. So I went back to retest all my ideas and spoke with contacts. And I'm more convinced than ever in this story. Last month I was speaking with Chinese furniture manufacturer. He heads up the Chinese Furniture Manufacturing Association in Beijing. He had just returned from a trip to the Middle East, first to source new markets because the Middle East was still his fastest growing market, but also to look for investment opportunities in response to trade protectionism. He felt that if he had a factory, for instance, in Egypt, then he would be protected from trade protectionism. It would also give him an opportunity to export to Europe as production costs in China itself start to rise. So more convinced than ever in this story. My third point is that you won't find Asian tigers in the Middle East. And I'm talking economics. Theoretically, Syria could grow at a 6% growth rate. It has raw materials, young labor force, access to large neighboring markets, not least Europe. Practically, it won't. And not least because, most Arab states are artificial constructs, and their populations are fragile, or the social makeup is fragile on the basis of tribal and, in particular, tribal and religious differences. So that's a major obstacle to the emergence of Asian tigers in the Middle East. That said, I don't think that's the correct focus. The Middle East has traditionally made its money as an intermediary. I think that will be true over the next century. We need to focus less on GDP growth rates and more on the activities of individuals such as Abdul Mattani, but also companies, as they operate as intermediaries between Asia, Africa, and Europe. And increasingly, you see the Chinese viewing Dubai in exactly that framework. I heard a story just the other day that Johannesburg is worried about Dubai's growing influence as a regional intermediary for Africa, and is taking trade in either goods and services from South Africa. The final point, again, to emphasize, and I still think it's the most important, is that Islam is central to this Silk Road story. So, again, if you were to travel from Korea to Morocco, you'd pass through about 40 countries. More than 30 of those countries have majority Islamic populations. Two of them, China and Singapore, have large minority Islamic populations. And Islam has fairly strong views about trade and finance. I mean, I recall an example in Syria, for instance. For the last 5 decades, the country has had largely a state-owned banking sector that has had no Islamic banks. So it pays interest on its deposits. 60% of the Syrian population refused to accept the interest on their deposits. And that, to me, sends a sort of powerful statement about the role Islam has to play in the economy, and it's one thing that I don't think that the charts and the tables, that the acronyms like BRICS and CHIMES really fully capture. So it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ben. With that, I'd like to throw it out to questions from our members here. And while you think about those questions, why don't I just put in one in the first? How do you come up with 70? It's higher than 50 now. I would think also you might see some kind of a range in terms of. a higher number would probably be more sustainable with higher levels of global growth anyway. Is that 70 coming more out of your work on China than out of your work on the Middle East in terms of what is a sustainable level for both sides at either end of the Silk Road?
It is coming out of my work on the Middle East. On China. To be honest, it's more a gut feel. A few years ago, we would have said 50 was unsustainable. But I think the corporate sector has adjusted. 70 appears sustainable. I say 70, though, for a number of reasons. The first is that the Saudis are targeting $70 a barrel. Ali Naimi is targeting $70 a barrel. He also spoke at a conference just a few weeks ago. I think the chief of India's Reliance was at the same conference, and he also said $70 appeared to be a reasonable level. So when you have some of the fastest growing producers and consumers of oil agreeing on that $70 a barrel level, it feels sort of instinctively right.
Okay. First here, and then the gentleman next to you.
Can you give us an idea of the value of trade between China and the Middle East and what you anticipate the growth rate in the next, let's say, 5 years to be?
I can. Sorry, I have the figure here. I'll have a look. I can't recall it off the top of my head. But China has overtaken both the UK and Germany in the 1990s as a larger seller of goods to the Middle East. It is just short of the United States. In terms of, and my guess would be in the next year or so, it will overtake the United States as the larger provider of goods to the Middle East. And to me, that's impressive because the United States tends to sell SUVs and Boeing aircraft. So the Chinese are selling DVD players and pajamas. If they can move up that value-added chain and start to say sell SUVs and Boeings, then the increase in trade will rapidly increase. Yeah, I'll come back to you on that figure.
Yeah. Gentleman next to her. Over here.
Do you have a view of the stability or the long-term viability of the Yemeni government? Reason I ask is there was an article in Bloomberg today which was talking about the concept of this maybe the next lawless state in the region, which is probably the last thing anybody needs. But I'm not sure if you're a Yemeni expert, but just curious as to if you have a personal view on that.
I visited Yemen in the early 90s, just after the Civil War. And I think it was one of the few foreign tourists in the country, and it's a very unusual country. It's really like going back to the 16th century, to be honest. So is it another potential failed state? I would say yes. That said, Abdullah Saleh, the current president, seems to have a fairly firm grip, and he has had a fairly firm grip for almost a decade now on power. So I think it's certainly in a better position than Afghanistan, but there's a serious risk.
Over here.
The Hong Kong government talked about the Middle East as a potential new growth area for Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong being part of China, how can Hong Kong best work with China to take advantage of this new opportunity?
The Hong Kong government's made fairly aggressive steps in the last 2 years. To try and position position the city as a center for Islamic finance. I think its intention is often misunderstood. There's an assumption that it wants to compete with Malaysia and Singapore, and that simply isn't true. What it wants to do is to be a center for Chinese corporates wanting to issue Islamic bonds. And in that respect, I think it has everything to gain. Why not? Chinese corporates will naturally want to come to Hong Kong first to raise any sort of finance abroad. I know Donald Tang was just recently in Saudi Arabia. So they're taking all the right steps. Obviously, Hong Kong's disadvantage is it doesn't have a large Muslim population. It has just two big mosques and one smaller mosque. It's very difficult to find halal food, if not impossible. I think the Shangri-La is the only hotel that offers halal food. But that said, things are changing. There were 19,000 Saudi visitors to Hong Kong in the last few years, a year. If you walk around some of the bigger shopping malls, you'll hear Gulf dialects. You'll see women dressed in the full black. So it's changing.
Here, please, and then over in the corner.
Thanks very much. You present a very pragmatic view of the Silk Road, I think, past, present, and future. And my question is really about the more radical or fundamentalist elements that we see and we hear about, and whether you see those as presenting any natural constraints to your model, your views on that, and whether there comes a point where purely through self-motivation, the problem corrects itself internally because some of the vested interests along the Silk Road decide it's in their best interest to solve this problem on their own behalf?
It's a big question. I'm going to answer it from the point of view of an economist. I think that's the easiest way. It's definitely a challenge and definitely a constraint. And it's one reason I think we have to focus on individuals, not companies and not GDP growth rates. Because in terms of GDP growth rates in particular, the region may not look always that promising. Pakistan is a good case in point, but that doesn't mean Pakistani traders will still play a very important role in the rise of the East and the rise of Silk Road economies. You do see a rise of liberal elements, in particular from Turkey. There's a project underway at the moment to try and reinterpret the Quran, to try and present an alternative point of view from those of the fundamentalists. So there is reason for hope. That said, the region has a huge youth population. The large bulk, I think the figures, I've got them here, is around about 60% of the population is under the age of 30. In Asia in the 70s, that was a huge advantage because governments put that youth population to work and you had rapid GDP growth. There is a potential for the Middle East to put the youth to work. There is also the potential for them to fail to put them to work, and they will be radicalized as a result. And again, as an economist, I think one of the biggest problems in the Middle East is just jobs. To get married in the Middle East, you need a lot of money. You need to own a house, you need to own a car, you need to have a job, and that's very difficult. So what you get is a lot of young males in particular sitting at home at the age of, say, 30 or so, without a home, without a car, without a job, most importantly, without a wife or family to look after. And I think that in itself contributes to instability in the region. So if we do get the sort of economic growth that I expect, then the region will turn more stable. In this respect, if I diverge a little bit, I think one of the big advantages, and again, this is why we can't view events in isolation, one of the big advantages for the Middle East is China's pricing itself out of the market in terms of low value-added goods as production costs rise and so forth. It's an old argument. But I've done a few calculations, and if Syria, for instance, had just captured 1% of the increase in China's trade with Europe over the past decade, it would have added at least half a percentage point to growth. It's just a very small share. So I think as China moves up the value-added chain, there's a large opportunity for the Middle East to step in. But as always in the Middle East, there are never any guarantees.
In the corner, please.
Yes, in your talk today, you focused on the Gulf and maybe the Arabian Peninsula in terms of the connections with China. I haven't read your book, so I apologize if you covered this, but can you talk about the role of the original Silk Road went through Central Asia, what's now Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, et cetera. Is that going to be a major part of this, or will they be left on the side because with airline communication, internet, you can bypass that land route?
I think there is always the risk of that, of course, that you can bypass that route. But Islam will play an important role here in terms of linking countries together, in terms of their trade linkages. At the same time, I have to say these Central Asian economies are very, very small. And when you look at them as a share of the Silk Road itself, it's we're talking sort of a few percentage points. So while it's beneficial to them in terms of that trade go through the traditional land routes, it has very little limited impact on the rest of the region. I would also say China obviously faces competition from Russia in Central Asia, in particular in Kazakhstan, and that will be, in my view, an obstacle to its expansion in that region. The Central Asian countries are also very suspicious of China because of... it's fought a number of wars with Central... Well, historically, with the old Central Asian states, it's fought a number of wars, and particularly was suppressed Islamic populations over the past five centuries or so, and that's left them quite wary of Central Asia's role.
Ernst?
You mentioned how China is making good productive use of its Muslim
minorities out there as translators, as cultural ambassadors between the Muslim world and the Arab world and China. But obviously they have also an unrestive province out there, Xinjiang, which somehow does not, and this is connecting up to your question down there, which does not fit perfectly into your picture. And you don't, you wanted to answer the question only kind of as an economist, but nevertheless, can you particularly do this to Xinjiang, try to give us a practical question, how China can come to terms with its minority out there?
It's a good question. I think the first distinction to make is that the Chinese government itself makes a distinction between the Xinjiang province and Islamic Muslim separatists and the Huizhou minority. The Huizhou minority, many of them were descendants of the sort of original Muslim traders, scholars, soldiers who arrived during the Yuan dynasty and subsequently spread across the country. They've maintained their social cohesiveness, in short, Chinese scholars say, because of the role of the mosque and that these Muslim communities will situate themselves around the mosque. The Huizhou are the only of the 10 minorities that are identified by their religion, not their territory. So, in short, to get back to your question, the Chinese government distinguishes between the Muslim separatists in Xinjiang and the Huizhou, and it actually co-opts the Huizhou into government. You see, for instance, the vice deputy foreign minister who did speak on Al Jazeera in Arabic is a Huizhou. The United States State Department itself, on its reports on freedom of religious practice and so forth, has noted that in areas where there are not Muslim separatists, the Chinese government continues to build mosques and supports Arabic language instruction. So it does see a divide between those two. That said, it does have a small issue. A Chinese scholar did say to me a few weeks ago in Beijing that I did ask about the government's policy towards Gaza during the recent fighting. And he did suggest that the Chinese government has to be a little bit careful because the Huizhou have assimilated, and you can't distinguish them from the rest of the population, but they do still have some sympathies for foreign Muslims. So the government itself has to be a little bit cautious on its stance on Muslim issues abroad in the rest of the country with the Huizhou in mind.
Over here, and then next.
Could I ask you about Iran from an economic point of view, because you mentioned Syria. Iran has very considerable oil and gas reserves. It's rumored that there's quite a lot of diplomatic activity going on between the US and Iran, because they're looking at the post-Iraq situation so that they want a rapprochement. I've been to a couple of meetings in China where I've seen representatives from Iran, which are developing industrial parks, they're developing their chemical industry. Could you see a situation in 2 to 3 years' time where Iran could be an emerging economic power?
I think the Iranian economy is a bit of a disaster and has been for a while. So I struggle to see it working itself out of that situation for another decade or so. But you make a valid point in terms of the strong links between China and Iran. In part, I've had a number of Chinese scholars say to me, China has sympathies for Iran's long history. It's Persian history. You can obviously go back thousands of years and identify it as an unbroken history. China has made some investments, or it's signed contracts to make investments. In particular, Iran's oil and gas fields. There is one of those fields starts I don't speak Persian, so I actually can't pronounce the name. It's quite difficult. What was interesting, though, is just during the Iraq War, it signed the contract before the Iraq War. During the Iraq War, it fluctuated back and forth in terms of whether that contract would go ahead. And it fluctuated largely because it was very careful of not upsetting the United States. So it wanted to develop its relationship with Iran and be seen as a neutral partner, but it didn't want to upset the United States because it recognizes that the United States is ultimately the military power in the Middle East, and China imports 45% of its oil imports from the United States. So I think that's always a restraint on the relationship. But it's, and again, I'm not an Iranian expert, but it's a complex relationship, and yes, there are meant to be thousands of Chinese in Isfahan in particular, and you see a lot of Iranians in Beijing. But I just think the relationship is very, very complex.
Next gentleman here, please.
I grew up in Malaysia, where a large Chinese population lives next to the Muslim population. And I observed the stresses that generate, you know, because of the cultural differences and how the potential is not realized. So while the macroeconomic case you present for relations between China and Middle East are compelling, I don't know whether you're underestimating, you know, some of the micro issues. I'll give you an example. I have had friends in London who were willing to eat with me in the Jewish deli, whatever they may think of Israel, but he wouldn't come with me to a Chinese restaurant. And you know, a person from Turkey obviously can, you know, get along well in China because they have accommodated China, I mean Islam, into a domestic sphere. But in the Middle Eastern countries where Islam is so dominant a force, I wonder whether the, you know, the day-to-day accommodations may be quite more difficult than you imagined.
I guess it's a fair point, Malaysia. I think the social frictions are often underestimated. I would say Malaysia is perhaps a little bit exceptional in that, as far as I can recall, it's probably the only country, or one of the few countries in the Silk Road, where you have a large ethnic Chinese and ethnic Muslim population living side by side. So I think there's sort of historical social frictions there. I don't want to be too optimistic, and it's one reason I don't like the acronyms BRICS and CHIMES, because I think they tend to focus our attention on GDP growth rates, and either you're rising or you're slowing, and that's the story. I think we got to get beyond GDP growth rates and look at what are the activities of individuals. So when, for instance, when Malaysia's Maybank buys into an Islamic or Pakistani Islamic securities lender or financial insurance firm, that to me is should be the real focus. And it does suggest, again, the rise of the East and rise of linkages within the East. So I would want to be more optimistic and focus on that part of the economy, but without ignoring the risks that you do point out.
Over here, please. And then in the corner.
The Saudi and the Gulf governments are mostly still beholden to the U.S. for protection and for security reasons. Given what you said, given, you know, the flow of commodity, of oil, is there a scenario where they actually shift their allegiance to China?
I don't think the Saudis will. The Saudis are hedging. And I think there's a recognition that the relationship has with the United States. It hasn't broken down, but it's considerably weaker than it was. And that recognition is seen both in Riyadh and Washington. I don't think the Chinese and the Saudis fundamentally understand each other. And I think that's a major problem. On the one hand, you have an orthodox Islamic state. On the other hand, you have a capitalist Confucius state, if you like. And to go from Beijing to Riyadh is just, you know, two opposite ends of the earth. But I think there's a recognition in Riyadh that by hedging their bets and increasing trade linkages with China offers them an opportunity to push back against the United States, particularly when it comes to issues of criticism of their own domestic policies. I think they'll always play off both sides. Yeah. In fact, I think one of the biggest surprises for me is when you start researching a subject like this, there's a tendency to want to assume oil is at the center of it, and it really isn't. And what I was surprised is that relations between Saudi and Arabia are quite superficial, and they all take place at the government level. You walk around Riyadh, you won't see Chinese traders on the street. It's very unusual. Walk around Beijing, you won't see Saudis on the street. An American friend of mine who was an advisor to a wealthy Saudi investor, he lives now in Beijing, and he's often called up by the Chinese as a Saudi expert simply because they have no other alternatives.
Here and then in the corner, please. Here, I'm sorry. Well, okay, here you have it after all. Okay. I'm sorry, and then I'll let the gentleman.
Could you talk a little bit about what you think the implications for the US dollar are of this relationship? You see China being very concerned about the value of the dollar and its sovereign fund, and obviously the Middle East sovereign fund, same issues. So China are talking about new reserve currency, and I think the Saudis being quite supportive at the G20. And then you have other dynamics like the Gulf countries looking at a single currency, depegging from the US dollar, and then even maybe giving up the petrodollar. How do you see all this playing out?
It's a big question. Taking it from the China angle, I would say the Chinese government has had long-standing ambitions to try and raise the yuan to the status of a reserve currency, if only because it's in their own self-interest. For exporters to transact in yuan is cheaper. It's also a natural hedge against large fluctuations in the value of the dollar, and it was those large fluctuations in the yuan against the dollar that caused some pain in the first half last year. So I think that is partly what underlines China's ambitions. The Middle East is a little bit more ambiguous. I know I said before that there's a big gulf between China and Saudi Arabia, and yet a lot of Arab Gulf senior officials were all educated in the United States, and they all speak fluent English. They have sympathies for the United States, so they recognize that the United States is still the world's largest economy, still the world's largest consumer of oil. And I think sort of intentions for them to drop the dollar, or their stance towards the dollar is perhaps a little bit less aggressive. They still feel that the dollar has a role to play, but perhaps a reduced role, and that eventually they will move to basket pegs. And the basket pegs, the Arab Gulf economies currently fix their currencies to the dollar, but the assumption is they eventually will move to a basket peg that includes the euro and the dollar. So again, the Middle East tends to see China, I feel, tends to see issues in terms of black and white. The Middle East tends to see only gray, and will always hedge its political relationships, will hedge its economic interests. That said, you do raise one point, is that the level of comfort in their investments in the United States has fallen, in particular as a result of the Patriot Act. And there is a sense that, given another September 11, they would come under renewed scrutiny. And so there's less, perhaps, interest in investing in American assets than there was in the past, and more interested in diversifying. But like any big sovereign wealth fund, you face the problem of that the United States is still the world's largest economy and has the world's deepest financial markets and so forth. So there aren't a lot of alternatives.
Over here now, please.
Ben, thank you for your insights. Self-declared interest in aviation, and it's already been touched on. The Dubai Air Show in November 07 was what many people called the end of irrational exuberance for ordering aircraft. 325 large commercial aircraft were ordered in 4 days. And Emirates will receive, if they stay on schedule, 3 times more A380s than any other airline in the world. Yet, as we all know, there are other airlines very close by. Is the Dubai Emirates build it and they will come business model sustainable in your view? Because some of our members are rather anxious to know the answer to that. Thank you.
Okay. I'm a big fan of Dubai still. I think it's leveraged, but I think it's leveraged. It's obviously over leveraged to credit, but it's also over leveraged to growth in this region. And it obviously went too far, and it's now struggling. It lacks oil resources to try and prop the economy up. It does enjoy support from Abu Dhabi. There are strong interlinkages between the families because of intermarriage. So Abu Dhabi will step in to support Dubai. Dubai won't grow as fast as it did in the past. It really went too far. But this is an intermediary in what will be still one of the world's fastest growing economies or growing fastest growing regions in the world, and that's the East. And China, for instance, views Dubai as a strong intermediary between itself and Africa. At the same time, it's worth underscoring that the decisions that took Dubai to where it is today were not taken over the past decade. They've been taken over the past 150 years. So you can go back to the late 19th century to see the ruler of Dubai at that point cut tariffs quite significantly to turn Dubai into a free port. The Rashid bin Said al-Maktoum in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. He dredged the ports. He built an international terminal. He cut duties completely to turn it into a genuine free duty port, and they made good money on the back of that. I think that story is still very compelling. Whether or not they can support those level of aircraft orders, I think, is less a question for Dubai and is more a question of, will China recover? If it does, where will oil prices be if they're at $70 a barrel and the Middle East recovers? And then how much conviction do you have in Africa? And if you do have a fair level of conviction, then I find the story very compelling.
And as for Emirates, they're hoping that swine flu is not a problem globally. If you look at airline stocks this morning, we have time for one last question. Do we have a new question? If not, we'll ask somebody. Allow somebody to ask a second, please, here in the front, in the middle.
I was just wondering, you had talked about the Muslim connection and China. How does Israel fit into the picture, being in the Mideast and being the one non-Muslim country?
Israel is interesting. There is a growing, what they call Tinipai in China, an Israeli faction. And it grows in part because China has respect for Israel's economy, its military, and again, like Iran or Persia, it's a 5,000-year-old civilization. So there is an affinity there. And the Israelis have worked very hard in the Chinese media to try and turn around attitudes towards China. And I read a number of blogs in particular after events like the fighting between Hezbollah and Israel in 2006. And I would have said the views on the issue were split and evenly between pro-Hezbollah, pro-Arab, and pro-Israel. So I think the view from the government is very different from the view of the average person. I think there is genuine support for Israel. I think that may be a stumbling block for China. The Arabs are not unaware of China's support for Israel. I watched an interview of the Vice Deputy Foreign Minister Huizu, an Arabic-speaking Huizu, on Al Jazeera. The interview ran quite smoothly for the first 20 minutes, and then Ahmed Mansour turned to him. It was on No Limits. Ahmed Mansour turned to him and really got stuck into him about, why is it that you still buy military equipment from Israel? Why is it that you didn't support or didn't veto American action or United States action in Iraq and so forth? So it's a potential stumbling block.
With that, thank you very much. It's 2 o'clock. We try to wrap up at 2. We always like to give our guests something to remember the FCC by.
Thank you very much.
We have a package for you. Thank you all for coming, and we hope to see many of you again on Wednesday evening for Nayan Chanda. Thank you very much for coming.
If you come on Wednesday, it's quite a similar topic. I have to come and have a look at it. It's very interesting.
This guy is very, very important. From the center. I think we need a picture. Well, thank you. I'll put this here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah.
Put a lot of thought into it. I didn't know about the way two minorities rule, and it's really a very, very, very interesting process as well.
Thank you very much. And thank you.
Have a drink sometimes.